I think I'm just going to start with showing some images of that, which I wanted to end with this, but who says things have to be chronological? I don't have PowerPoint still. But this is the room. I have some textile cloth curtain, and they move like this. It's a rectangular room, quite high to the ceiling. I believe it was 5 or 6 meters in a room slightly smaller than this. And then I had 14 speakers on the floor, underneath the floor, playing in this rather dark room. Sound of the ice that I recorded with accelerometers, which are kind of vibration sensors that I put on ice surfaces and ice pieces of ice. Something that you don't really hear with your naked ear. And then I recorded, those were all spread out on the floor. On this space, it's difficult to get an idea of it, but this is just the sort of the cloth. This is maybe a bit better. That, let me just see if I can minimize this a bit, like this. And then what I did as well was to record with hydrophones, underwater microphone, that I sunk 20 meters below the surface. So both recordings, not something you could hear really with your bare ears. And to me, this was an attempt to create something that embraced that fascination of the unknown, which what I learned also being part of this exhibition now is that it's not only a contemporary art show, it's also for the, like it shows the early expeditions from Franklin Expedition and André, who tried to fly to a North Pole in an air balloon, which is a beautiful and tragical story. The original photos were there from his expedition. He was gone for, went missing for 33 years, but they found photos. So I was sent there as well, not only as an artist, but in a way also as one of many explorers who go out to the world and explore something and just come home with something. And which is just an idea, you know, an idea of a space. It's not, for me, it wasn't an attempt to create something real or to make a documentary or a documentation of this is how it sounds like. But because if you travel to the Arctic, you will see something which might be like icebergs or light blue colors maybe. But there is, it all depends how you listen, you know, and how you understand your environment. And with this equipment that I was using, I could dive below the surface and listen to that world underneath the water, which sounded like this. Loudspeaker is also making some sound, playing with it. But since sound travels more or less 4 times faster in water, you could hear this, these ice chunks falling into the water at a huge radius. Sometimes I would hear it below, no, above the surface as well, but then a little bit delayed, so I would hear the same thing 2 times. So that was then combined with the recordings from within the ice that was spread on the floor. So this is for me a way to understand the Arctic from a sound perspective. I mean, when you listen or when you hear about the Arctic, I think nowadays is everything we hear about is texts and pictures like describing how the poles are melting, and it's like almost impossible to think about the Arctic without thinking of the global warming or the numbers and the pictures we have all seen of the glaciers disappearing. And I wanted to create something that only speaks in sound, doesn't say necessarily like, I mean, of course this is like sound of a melting, but it's always been melting, so in one or the other way, or things have always gone in different ways. So to me it was more like experiencing the force of the place, an immense force that lives especially underneath me in this crystal clear water. Yeah, you can go and see it if you go to Copenhagen or Denmark. But my actually one of my inspirations that really sparked my inspiration was when I read your book Dark Khan, where you quote the Gargantua and Pantagruel, the François Rabelais Frozen Sounds episode, which maybe I should read it. Do you mind if I read it, Doug, from your book? Well, that was something that inspired me, because I will tell you afterwards, or you will know by yourself. But it was like this, and it fits quite well to the Arctic, I think, in a way. It's called Frozen Sound, at least to me. Out at the sea, with a little in sight, a strange assortment of sounds are heard. Pantagruel suggests to his shipmates that the sounds might be from equilateral triangle formed by the contiguity of several worlds, the center of which holds nothing less than the truth, along with the words, ideas, copies, and images of all things past and to come. So that was like what he imagined those strange sounds to be, as far as I understand. After this and other explanations prove unsatisfactory, the skipper intervenes to put an end to speculation. Their location skirts the frozen sea, the site of a bloody battle during the winter between the Arimaspians and the Nephelibates. Such battle sounds would include the words and cries of men and women, of the hacking, splashing, and hewing of battle axes, the shocking knocking and jolting of armors and harnesses, the neighing of horses, and all other martial din and noise that you heard during this war out there on the sea. It was so cold that the sounds froze and fell to the ground and never reached the ears of the combatants. Perhaps the whole battle was silent. Even though sounds in general might lack the humidity of the breath, it was as though they took the form of speech, and speech became but a vaporizer of thought. But now that it was springtime, all these sounds, long inaudible, were being released and creating a racket, although not in their original temporal sequences of action. Pantagruel found irrefutable evidence strewn over the ground of the island. These still frozen sounds seemed like your rough sugar plums of many colors, like those in heraldry. Friar John held what he thought was a big word in his hands. So that was something, you know, for me, that just made me think, wow, sounds, how to capture sound, you know, can sound freeze? Can it be captured in some way and just stored? Just like we have had images of people or whatever exploding or something, you have like a shadow on the wall of somebody or somehow, I know this sounds a bit violent, but in a way, some evidence have been captured, or like at the in Italy, where this what's it called, this where they had the volcano and everything. Yes, Pompeii. Thanks. And I was thinking if sounds really can store themselves by accident and be sort of come out at some other time. I mean, some of you might have also heard of these theories of the vases. The vases where these ladies in ancient Greece, I guess, sat and made spinning vases, like, you know, what you do when you do like a clay vase, and then print a needle into the vase in order to create a line around it. And then while talking, they would accidentally move the needle and sort of print the vibration of the sound through the air into that vase. I believe that some of the first recordings of sound was made in Sud. But yes, anyway, I'm not a professor on that, but that is basically what these kind of thoughts that have inspired me to go to search for sound and to really believe that sound does exist or it is being trapped somehow. But that is not something I try to prove or to say on my pieces or in my, you know, albums or whatever I release. But however, some of these things brought me to, or ideas brought me to Chernobyl, still radioactive zone of exclusion in Ukraine, to record sound of abandoned rooms. I can show you some of them. Let me see. This is a church. One of the four spaces I recorded. There is also a swimming pool and an auditorium where people, you know, played music, and a gym. And here they did praying, of course, or like spiritual things. And I decided to, I thought, how could I record these spaces? How could I understand that space? So I thought, okay, I could let myself inspire by Alvin Lucia's work. I'm sitting in a room, who, what you explained so nicely about how to do that piece. So I guess you know that by now. But I decided not to speak or not to be present myself in the room, and just to leave a microphone in the space, and then press record, and then leave the building, and then let it record for itself. And then after 10 minutes, I returned and played that recording that I had just recorded of the space back into the space again, just quietly, sort of just to try to add another level, another layer of that ambient sound that was existing in the room. And then I recorded again and went out, left the building. And then I continued this process. That means I was layering the ambient sound of the space, which made each room that I did it in slowly sort of rise in its resonant frequencies. And out of this, you know, occurred the resonant frequencies of these rooms. This is the first layer of, or the first recording of one of the rooms, not this one you're seeing here. This is the loudspeaker. That's not on the recording. I would like to try to play. I'll play the second layer of the recording you just heard. This is not this room again. So I'll turn it off. Sounds like this. Oops, sorry. to me, many things occurred, like when I was actually in Chernobyl, that I hadn't thought of before. One thing was that, of course, I knew that these places were radioactive, and you can think of these spaces as something that human beings had to leave, and then they would be empty, but they left because something was... That's okay, yeah. Yeah. It's an annoying sound. It's a... Okay, yeah, but now I can't play anything. Anyway. Okay, cool. I think one thing is that it was inhabited by something else, radiation. So that was the reason why it was not inhabited by us anymore, because something else came. And that thing I can't understand. So I thought to myself, how can I understand radiation, radioactivity? And I wanted, then I thought, okay, I could start with the time, because we all heard that radiation lasts for a very, very long time. 70,000 years is some of these, this radiation that is in Chernobyl, it will last for this long, which made me completely understand that space that I showed you in a completely different way, because recording the resonance of this space that occurred between these walls were made as a kind of, you know, as a layering of sound, but also of time, because I used 10 minutes, spent 10 minutes recording this room, picking up this time of that space, 10 minutes of this 70,000 years to come in a way to me, and then play that back into the room for another 10 minutes, and then play that back into the room for another 10 minutes, and then have, in the end, 1 hour and 10 minutes, which allowed me, or like, to actually expand my perception to hear something that was already there, because those frequencies are already there. But you could then hear them or go beyond my perception by using that space, but also, in a way, look into the future, you know, maybe, I thought, because I would listen to a longer time in a shorter time. But that's, for me, what that space could do. I would also like to talk about another piece I've worked very much on and presented a lot of spaces, which is called Labyrinthitis. And that is very much concerned about the space between our ears, or inside our ears and inside our head. It is a piece that is based or created by tones that my ears have produced. I don't know how many of you know, who don't know my work already, that the ears can produce tones. But they can. The technically or medically it's called autoacoustic emissions. It's our the hair cells inside our cochlea, their little round spiral organ, that I found some of these images, which I can't find quite beautiful. This is the cochlea, the little round spiral here, and it is, there are small hair cells in there that vibrate when sound enters. Now I don't know how much I should actually go into explaining about this project, or like what how it actually works. Maybe I should, because then you'll understand what goes on. Basically, there is this thing called autoacoustic emissions, and there are two different ones, roughly. There are spontaneous autoacoustic emissions, and there are evoked autoacoustic emissions. And the spontaneous ones are, there are some people's ears who produce tones. And the scientists from that I worked with on this project, from Center of Applying Hearing Research in Denmark, couldn't give me an exact explanation of why some ears produce those tones, or some hair cells basically vibrate constantly and produce tones. I thought it was extremely interesting because I was using many years before that also, but to listen to you know, the world and underneath things, and really try to put my ear at many different places where to expand my horizon. Recently, actually, I was in Tanzania to record for a film, and at night there was just nothing to do. I could only be in my hotel, and at night there was also no electricity, so I had to be there under my mosquito net. And fortunately, I could charge my computer during the day. So I had brought with me Twin Peaks. So I was watching Twin Peaks every night. One chapter, you know, the season two is quite long, you know, you have a lot of chapters. So I was lying there in Tanzania in the middle of nowhere, like really, it was like out in the bush. It was a documentary about albinos and the killings of albinos. And it was actually in the area where that happened. So watching Twin Peaks was like really the perfect thing to do. And I remember the giant, he appears and he says to Agent Cooper, "The owls are not what they seem." Do you remember? That's perfect, you know. The sounds are not what they seem, I thought, you know, because this is really what I've been believing in all the time. You know, it's you have a sound or you have a person. I'm me, you know. You think you know me? You know, you will know that when you get closer to me, you will find out that I have many layers behind the sort of skin and what you see. And so it's a very personal project in a way, or journey to be on, I think, to record sound and to say, okay, they are not what they seem. It depends on our perception, it depends how we listen, it depends on what equipment we use. I'm diving in under the water in Greenland, or I'm like, how can I experience Chernobyl? And that, I think, is something that is interesting for me as an artist. Not to be a scientist, it is to create that space where you can actually experience the Arctic or experience a Chernobyl without having to think, oh, are you against or are you pro nuclear power? That is not interesting, you know, because the radiation, radioactivity, no matter if you like it or not, it's an incredible thing that people have created. You know, 4,000 years ago they created the pyramids like a testament of their time. We have created radiation that reaches 70,000 years into the future. I mean, 40,000 years ago we had an ice age, right? So maybe in 50,000 years some people will maybe find our radiation and they will, okay, you know, die. And they will find out, like, yo, that was what they did 50,000 years ago. That's pretty cool. I mean, nobody talks about that. I don't know if anybody talks about it, but I think that's really something that reaches beyond ourselves. No pyramid will be able to do that. And so I think that's an important thing. So sounds are not what they seem. Chernobyl is not what it seems. I'm not what you think. But basically, about the, sorry? Yeah, the ears, ear. So that's exactly the thing, you know. Some people have these autoacoustic emissions, the sounds of their ears, they just produce tones. And I asked one of the scientists there, why do you think it is? And then he said, I don't know. We're trying to find out, but it could be something about something to do with the feedback of the ear. And if that's the case, does that mean, I'm just asking myself if it means that the ear has a memory. I mean, if there is a feedback, there must be that's a kind of a memory, you know, the ear picks up something and resonates with it and keeps on producing something. But anyway, I had to have my ears recorded because I wanted to do that piece for based on tones from the ears of the artist himself. How cool is that? So I found these scientists, and they agreed to record my ears. And I haven't told you what evoked emissions are yet, but I'll tell you. But I went into this soundproof booth and got a microphone in my ears and had to just sit very still. And then I came out and they were like, your ears are completely quiet. Even though I have tinnitus, you know, tinnitus, there is absolutely no sound. It's actually quite extraordinary quiet. There is no autoacoustic emissions in your ears. So at first I was quite disappointed. But then I had to get back into this little booth and have my ears, or the tones, evoked, played. And because this is something you can do, and this is what they do when they want to determine whether babies can hear, because babies can't talk, you know, and tell, you know, do you hear this tone? Yes, no. So what they do is to play two tones into the ear. Those two tones have a ratio of not that sound. 1 to 1.2 is the ratio. So that ratio or interval has to be the same, no matter if it's two higher tones or two lower tones. And they found out that when you have one tone played into the ear, you will have a standing wave in the cochlea. Oh, that looks terrible. Sorry, I maybe should get some PowerPoint at some point. You see the hair cells here. And there is this basilar membrane. And when one pure tone enters the ear, you have a standing wave that then, where the hair cells are connected here, will vibrate and kind of open and send neural signals, electrical currents to the brain that this sound is coming. So if you have these two tones of this ratio, you have not only two standing waves, but also what they call a distortion product, which is an extra standing wave. And that causes that vibration that triggers the ear to play a tone right there. So that's how to evoke a tone in your ear. And they can therefore also predict exactly what tone is being played in the ear. That means if they play 1,000 hertz in plus 1,200, then they will have a slightly lower tone, maybe 970 something. This is something you can calculate. And they taught me how to calculate this too. So they will listen. Do we hear this tone in the ear of the baby? Yes, the baby can hear. But as a matter of fact, it's the ear that plays that tone. And you can record it with a microphone. So that was what they did to my ear. They played two tones into my ear and placed a microphone in there as well. And what I could hear, because I'm musically trained, I could hear three tones easily, which made me realize that I could hear my own ear play. Because I could hear the tone that my ear played in response to these two tones, which meant that I didn't only hear my own ear play, which is a paradox in itself, but also heard my ear, my self-hearing. I heard myself hearing, right? Because I heard this tone, because I heard the other two tones. If I didn't hear these two tones, I wouldn't hear my own ear play. You understand? So I got my ear sounds tones recorded and created a composition with them that was based exactly on this principle of these tones, which I'll explain briefly, and then I'll play that for you. Basically, since the third tone is slightly lower and can be predicted, my ear tones fade out of the speakers, fade in slowly, louder and louder, and as they are at their peak, these two tones from my ear trigger a tone in your ear. Right? Because this is the ratio. And since I know what frequency I am producing in your ear, I have taken one of my ear tones and tuned it into that tone, that frequency as well. So when these two tones enter, and produce a tone in your ear. They will then fade out after that climax, and then this tone that was produced in your ear, I'll then replace that tone with my ear tone. That's slightly lower. And then I have calculated what's the ratio of that 1:1.2 of that one, and to fade, then I fade these two tones in. And they produce another lower tone in your ear that I then also introduce with my ear frequencies. So the composition is made entirely on how the resonant frequencies or the resonance of the ear, of the hearing works. Well, that's in a way working with the space from like within our ears. But since I play the sounds out in the room, you will also experience the space within, from your head to your room. Because if you play the tones straight into the ears, as the doctors would do, they don't want any funny bouncing of frequencies. It's more difficult to hear or distinguish what tones are played by your ear and what tones are played by the loudspeaker in your ear, because the distance is almost zero. But if you place the sounds over here, you'll be able to hear, hopefully, what happens in your ear. So now I should, that's not enough talking for now. I hope this works on these speakers. So I'd like to ask you to listen to your ears, and just, you can also move the head. Sometimes there are more things happening. Some frequencies are better than others. If you block your ears, it won't have the effect, of course. But can you turn up the sound of the microphone, please? So I once presented this in a public space upstate New York in a train station, which didn't work at all. People got really, really freaked out by it when they walked, because when you walk, you have the multiple frequencies entering your ear, and if you don't know what's happening, is that your camera? Cool. Great sound. It's okay. If you don't know what's happening to your ears, because it's something like really entering your inner space. You know, it's very intimidating. So that's why I always explain a bit, and usually I also say it's not dangerous. But that piece was taken down after one day or so because they got massive complaints. The curator was happy, so I was happy. I don't know how much time I've got. It's now, right? Yeah. Not sure if you can. Because there is a. I mean, yes, but I think there is a panel. Yeah. Just want to play one sound, if it's okay. Can you turn up the sound a bit? So we were just talking about this singing sense. I was just telling you about it, and I just wanted to play a sound file. This is from within, inside these dunes. It's another kind of space, so-called singing sands, booming dunes, which interested me because of the mythological stories and about it. I thought it was a myth. I didn't know it really existed. Just the word singing sands. I read about it in this book from 1926 or 7 called Tales of Travel by Lord Curzon, and there was this tales of or accounts of travelers back to 2,000 years who had been writing about this phenomenon. And then I found some scientists who were interested in this, who also didn't know really what it was, and to record it, but the sound fitted well to the massiveness of the desert. So as I said, I was not really explaining so much about what I did with the, you know, this piece became a video sound work, others installations. But yeah, thank you. Thanks.